Out of a mine up Skitterbridge way. Nice bunch of girls, actually. Very professional. Never wore any... He made a motion over his chest with both hands, and seemed to go into a trance for a few seconds before shaking himself out of it. Anyway, long story short, the Adventurers Guild started putting pressure on the mine's owner, so he got sick of the whole business, and Slippery John had to sign up for the adventure trail. The Harpies set up a gentleman's club a few leagues east, Slippery John heard. Slippery John hasn't been, but apparently it's nice if you're into that. "But where did the guild come from?" said Merrill. Slippery John shrugged. "Someone had to look after the money. And then absolute money corrupted absolutely, of course. They're everywhere now. Can't move for agents and guild houses. Slippery John heard they're setting up offices in Garethy and Anorexia next year." "Can't someone stop this?" said Merrill, pointedly. "What, like a hero?" I snapped. "Anyway," said Slippery John in a sing-song voice. "Getting back on track, the whole fugitive thing does add a bit of a spanner in the whole plan with the magic resistance. But Slippery John reckons there won't be too much of a problem. They're only an organized army of ruthless psychotics with limitless resources. But no worries. Slippery John's licked fatter problems than this." A croissant skidded through the bars, and his voice dropped into a whisper. "There's a key to your cells in there. Most people just escape by killing themselves and getting another body outside, but obviously that's not on your menu. Slippery John can't help you any more than that, because Slippery John suspects he was spotted by every guard in this place on the way here."
"There he is!" screamed a gruff voice.
"Whoops, gotta go. Meet up with you later."
Then he scuttled off, followed closely by a clattering group of armed soldiers in furry hats.
"What did he say?" said Merrill from the next cell. "I didn't catch his last bit."
I put the croissant next to the scone. "He said to hold tight," I said. "He's going to go off and organize an escape, but it might take some time."
"Oh, cool."
"He also said it's very important that we all be absolutely silent for a while. It's because of reconnaissance or something."
"He can count on me."
Having ensured that Merrill wouldn't distract me for a while, I folded my arms and waited for the cries of pursuing guardsmen to fade away. Then I lay back, closed my eyes again, clamped my arms around my head, and visualized a badger until I could almost taste it. "Oh, fuck!" My cell door clanged open. A stout figure seized me by the legs and threw me over his shoulder, knocking the wind from me before I could say, "Wah!" or "Ow!" or "What the bloody hell are you doing?" I spent a few confused minutes staring down my captor's back at the dungeon floor as I was carried through the tunnels. Then a threadbare carpet came into view, and I was dumped onto a squat, three-legged stool. The room I'd been transported to looked like a warden's office. It had apparently been in a state of advanced disuse for some time, but had recently been recommissioned. An ornate antique desk was lying pushed up against a wall with the legs broken off, while a much more modern replacement took pride of place in the middle of the floor. Behind it sat Mr. Wonderful. He seemed right at home, resting his feet on the desk and testing the point of his knife with a fingertip. Baug, for it was he who had carried me from the cell, took up his usual position nearby. Mr. Wonderful was holding a small thesaurus open on a marked page.
"Settled in yet, my embryonic troublemaker? Enjoying the cell?"
"Yes, it's nice, thank you."
"Really?"
He sucked a bead of blood from his finger.
"So what if I said we might have found a use for you, Something that might involve getting out into the open again? Would that not interest you?"
No, not really." Mr. Wonderful froze, smiling thinly. Then, in two sudden movements, he slapped his hand on the desktop and cleanly severed it at the wrist.
"Well then, tough titties!"
he screamed, squirting blood directly into my face, before calming down and daintily wiping his gushing stump with a small hanky.
I've still got a very lovely plot in my herb garden I've got in mind for you.
I closed my eyes for a few seconds until I could be ready to face the universe again. What do you want from me?
See, now that's the kind of attitude we like to see. Some nice, clever knuckling under. You have to really work at a fellow's knackers to make him knuckle under these days.
It has been observed that you are associating with a renegade who operates under the moniker Slippery John, said Baug.
Yeah, I said uneasily. We've crossed paths.
It is also known to us that the individual who calls himself Slippery John is operating on behalf of a clandestine organization officially referred to by our intelligence as the Magic Resistance and known colloquially as the Suicide Squad.
For a few precious moments in the dungeon, it had seemed like things were looking up, but now events were trickling back down towards uncertain and uncomfortable territory.
Yeah, he, mentioned something about that.
Our lugholes have also picked up some mutterings on the grapevine about those jerks being very keen to get their hands on some pre-infusion, post-alive carcasses that were stirring up trouble in Garethy,
said Mr. Wonderful, dreamily poking his exposed ulna with the tip of a knife and watching the pool of blood expand across the tabletop.
And sorry if I'm flying high above the mark here, but your accent struck me as rustic enough to fit the metaphorical bill.
Look, I don't know anything about them, I said, unable to look away from his mutilated wrist. I'm not bothered about finding them any more. I just want to stay in the cell.
Oh, but I think there is something you want, said Mr. Wonderful.
He was swaying and getting rather pale, probably from the blood still streaming gaily from his wrist.
You want to die. You were lucky enough to be killed before the infusion hit, and now you think you deserve your good fortune back. Don't give me that look. We make it our business to know things about people, my little something that's not really leaping to mind right now.
Can you kill me for good? I asked, probably too quickly. Total existence suspension has been successfully executed only by UALBs in the period following the infusion, said Baug.
UA what? I asked.
Unidentified angel-like beings.
Oh, right. Those.
But,
said Mr. Wonderful, now unable to lift his head from the desk,
Squadicites who are doing some stuff, interesting stuff, probably not far from a through break with all that dying thing, just bleh.
Then he collapsed off his chair and disappeared behind the desk. The Magic Resistance have been closely researching the infusion phenomenon and are rumored to be making progress in discovering a means to remove its effect from the world, said Baug, taking over Mr. Wonderful's seat. Their information will lead you closer to your goal. In return for your release and the non-infliction of bodily mutilation, you will re-establish contact with Slippery John, earn the trust of the Magic Resistance leaders, then suppliers with their identities and location.
You want to stop the Resistance, I translated aloud.
He didn't give a straight answer. Circumstances deriving from the infusion have created harmonious conditions for the Adventurers Guild's growth. Our desire is for these circumstances to remain, enabling us to continue offering services for the well-being of our clients and customers.
Talking to Baug was like talking to a garden gnome with slightly less personality, but I felt much less intimidated with Mr. Wonderful gone.
You're afraid that the Magic Resistance are going to find a way to restart entropy, and if they do that, demand for adventurers and quests will go through the floor.
You know, I've only met one other person who thinks the infusion was a good thing, and he was an insane vicar with deleters instead of a brain. I heard the sound of running feet coming down the hall towards us. Then the door flew open, and the latest incarnation of Mr. Wonderful entered, wearing a white bathrobe and heaving air in and out of his lungs like an old bellows.
"Must be nice living in a palace," he announced, catching his breath. "Having your very own chapel on site. I miss anything fun?"
"The prisoner has been informed of the task we have in mind for him and our reasons for assigning same," said Baug. "He has been analysing our motives in a tone I would describe as unsympathetic."
Mr. Wonderful fixed me with a hateful glare for a second, before it shifted back to his maniacal grin.
"You know what? I can relate."
He ousted Baug from his chair and recovered his knife, experimentally twirling it around his freshly restored fingers.
"You'd have to be some kind of frothing lunatic not to want the infusion to go away. Oh, my old body's still here. Anyone else hungry?"
"I don't eat."
"Really? But you look so well nourished."
He worked away with his knife for a second, before tearing the stiffening left forearm off his old body.
"Now I'd love for murder to go back to having the same impact it used to have, but I'm the kind of psychopath who understands the importance of loyalty."
He took a bite out of the bicep and resumed talking with his mouth full, blood running from between his teeth.
"So basically you're going to do what the Adventurers Guild wants you to do, or we're going to cut you into thin slices, wrap you around pickles, and sell you at a delicatessen counter. Fair?" "No, not fair at all. Of course it isn't. Don't know why I even phrased it as a question, really."
He sucked some unmentionable stains from his fingertips.
"Carry that with you at all times. Try to lose it and we'll track you down, stuff it down your gob, and sew your lips shut."
It was a lump of amber containing half a retel, a magical regenerating insect. I'd learned about them in mage school. They were used as tracking devices, because one half of it would always indicate towards the other in a fruitless quest to reconnect. It was probably cruel, but Mr. Wonderful, still busily consuming his own limb, clearly didn't let that bother him.
"You will be returned to your cell," said Baug. "Shortly a guard will hang the key loosely on their belt and feign sleep just outside the door. Escape and re-establish contact with Slippery John. Your progress will be monitored."
Baug spent most of his time standing perfectly still, but when called to action, he tended to execute several movements in extremely quick succession, as if he'd been queuing them up. Now he threw me over his shoulder again, and strode out of the room. Mr. Wonderful waved the severed arm and grinned madly.
"Bye!"
Once he'd hurled me back into my cell and slammed the door, Baug took up a carefully calculated position where he could be seen from both Merrill and Thaddeus's cells.
"My goodness me," he said loudly in his usual monotone. "You certainly are a tough nut to crack. I've never seen a prisoner undergo such horrific torment and not reveal a single thing. I am bowled over with newfound respect."
Then he marched stiffly away. A few moments later, an extremely fat and inept-looking guard lumbered into view, carefully set up a little stool on the ledge outside my cell, sat himself down, and began making loud, exaggerated snoring noises. "Keys," I reminded. He got halfway through a swear word before stopping himself. He brushed his belt a few times, pretending to be dusting himself off, until a ring with three large keys slid down to jangle freely from a hook on his belt. Obviously, you can't buy belts with hooks on, so he just stuck a cheap coat hook on with some masking tape. I leaned on the bars, drumming my fingertips, watching his belly rise and fall with sleep. Making any kind of agreement with Mr. Wonderful would be a bad idea of legendary proportions. Someone like him couldn't possibly be trusted to keep his word. He apparently couldn't be trusted to walk across a room without getting blood all over the carpet. Plus, it would be wrong. I froze. That had been an odd thought for me. It sounded more like something Merrill might say, and that's why it was rather disturbing to find in my head. No, I was fooling myself if I thought I had a choice. The only alternative was the herb garden, spending half the time being crammed speck by speck through tiny roots, and the rest being farted out into the soil. Blind, deaf, conscious, and excruciatingly bored for the rest of eternity. I sighed. "Don't bother," I said to the guard. "I'm okay for keys. You like scones?"
"I really can't get over how easy escaping from that dungeon was," said Merrill, once we were back in the daylight.
The sewage tunnels had opened out into a pathetic excuse for a public garden, somewhere in the scummy side of town. The kind of area where the upper class have been shitting on everyone for so long that a little more couldn't hurt. "Personally, I'm just glad to be out of there," I said. "Did Slippery John mention an address we could find him at?"
"Seriously, they must have really poor standards for guards in this part of the world," she continued. "That fat one outside your cell just kept sleeping while you were letting us out. And you were slamming the doors really loud."
It's all this big city living, probably. Makes you tired.
I'm wondering if we shouldn't go back and tell someone."
She took an uncertain look back at the tunnel entrance we had emerged from.
"I'm starting to think he might have had a heart attack or something."
"No, really, it's fine. I saw him wake up just before we left."
"Oh, okay. Actually, come to think of it, all those unlocked doors were a bit weird, too."
"Our quest is watched over by a higher power," said Thaddeus, who was just behind us. "Through me, the guidance of heaven steers your rank and unworthy feet."
I glanced at him for a second, then extended a hand and muttered a few words. He transformed into a grim-faced rabbit with a sternly twitching nose.
"What did you do that for?" said Merrill,
"as a witty conversational counterpoint, and to cheer myself up. I keep forgetting I have this spell." Rabbit Eos bared his teeth, then ballooned madly, stretching back out into human form.
"Make your merriment while you can, vile member of Azazel. The laughter will be mine when you toss forever in his flaming sink trap."
"Why the hell did I let you out?"
"Because it was the right thing to do," said Merrill firmly.
I stopped and hung my head, exasperated. "Please don't start that shit. We've been over this."
"Now come on. Even you have to admit that risking everything to bravely escape from unjust imprisonment, spring your friends, and fight your way out of the dungeon is a pretty traditionally heroic course of action."
"I wouldn't call it fighting our way out."
"Well, even so, going through a few doors someone left unlocked and crawling out through an unguarded sewer tunnel still isn't completely outside of Hero Town."
"Merrill, for God's sake, I'm not a hero. I just want to go to sleep."
"You're going to keep saying that, and you're going to keep saying that to the magic resistance when we find them, and you're going to keep saying it all the way through finding the deleters and removing the infusion and saving the world, and maybe then you'll realize how wrong you were all along."
I imagined myself shaking hands with Mr. Wonderful, as a deleter beam slowly evaporated everything that was me from the feet up. I saw a 50-foot Mr. Wonderful hand in hand with deleters skipping gaily across the land, spreading misery and despair among the immortal populace, trapped forever in unchanging bodies, and centuries of permanent slavery to a corrupt, omnipotent guild. I saw them curse my name between every heaving wail and sob as the betrayer who destroyed mankind's only chance of escape
from the insidious power of an otherworldly evil.
Oh, fine, I said. I suppose I must be the hero, then. We made our way further into the slums of Lolied City. It really was a wretched district. The streets were painfully narrow. If a carriage were passing through here, its windows would be pressed right up against the houses. Not that anyone rich enough to hire a carriage would be interested in such a grim sightseeing tour of society's bottom rung. Thaddeus hung back a few feet behind us, distributing from his limitless supply of pamphlets. We turned a corner and found ourselves in what I'm fairly certain was the Red Light District. It had the usual hallmarks, painted women in impractical stockings, furtive-looking gentlemen pretending to ask them for directions, and a curiously large number of discreet alleyways and massage parlours. "This seems like a good place to start looking for Slippery John," I thought aloud. Corpses were everywhere, but no one seemed to be bothered by it. The living simply picked their way around the stiffening bodies. A converted garbage cart was making its way slowly down the street, while two men in flat caps loaded the corpses onto it. A sign on the cart read, "O'Malley's Dog Food." Ahead of them, a handful of recent resurrectees wearing the standard church-issued white bathrobes were hunting through the piles, trying to recover clothing and possessions from their former selves before they became the property of Mr. O'Malley. We passed through a pedestrian precinct where my attention was drawn to a trough in the middle of the footpath. It had probably once contained plants, but they had been torn out and replaced with a bed of blood-stained 3-foot spikes. I was puzzling over this choice of landscaping when I heard a scream of defiance from overhead, and a woman in casual office attire flung herself from a rooftop, somersaulted several times in the air, then landed heavily on the points with an effect not unlike a generously filled jam sandwich being stamped on. Merrill broke into spontaneous applause, which earned her a few dirty looks.
"Funny how we never saw this sort of thing back in Garethy," she said, watching a man slumped against a wall attempting to strangle himself.
"I suppose Garethy wasn't that big on creative thinkers," I theorized aloud. We passed by a large brick wall that was part of the local jailhouse. The authorities had put up a large instructional poster depicting a wholesome-looking woman with a finger to her chin and a noose around her neck, beside the words, "Be responsible with your deaths. Don't let suicide addiction become your life." Once they'd put that up, though, the local residents had taken it as an invitation. Most of the details were covered by smaller, more lurid posters advertising a variety of services. "Bored housewife for bleed-outs and decapitation. Hot, hot cannibalism. Acid burns for discerning gentlemen." Each one had an address underneath, followed by the address of the nearest church. I was taking a closer look at a particularly colourful advertisement that asked me rhetorically if I'd ever tried lead poisoning, when Slippery John turned up. I spotted him out of the corner of my eye as he darted stealthily up the pavement towards us, his black outfit providing no camouflage whatsoever in the daytime sun. He was diving from cover to cover, repeatedly glancing back the way he'd come. I watched him roll back and forth between a postbox and a pile of corpses a few times, before I lost patience and walked up to him. "Hi."
"Ah!"
he cried, startled, before flattening his hands and pretending that his terrified jump had been some kind of martial arts move.
"Shouldn't sneak up on a master rogue like that, dead man. It's a good way to do yourself an injury."
"I'll bear that in mind," I said, with a level of deadpan that you have to be dead to get right.
"Right on, minion of foulness. We'd better get moving. We're supposed to be meeting Slippery John's contact in the underground tunnels."
"Weren't you being chased by guards?"
Witness how Slippery John effortlessly evades his pursuers at every turn. He took another lightning-fast, worried glance behind him. Yes, indeed, there's not a dungeon in the world that Slippery John hasn't strolled through as if the very walls were vapour. Except the one in Threadgrave's fortress, obviously, he added quickly, as one of my eyebrows began to climb up. You creatures caught Slippery John on an off day there. And there was that place in Anorexia where the guards all wore low-cut tops. I turned him into a rabbit. Moments later, a small platoon of armed guards from the palace dungeons jogged past, kicking their knees high and chanting, Hup! Merrill hastily picked up the rabbit and stroked it until they'd gone past.
Good timing.
I didn't know they were there. I just wanted him to shut up for a second.
Oh, psh! It was the heroic instincts hastening your arm, right?
This time I pictured Mr. Wonderful dancing a tango with Baug on the ruined, undying body of the human race as it cried out for me to save it. For a moment, the human race looked a hell of a lot like Merrill. Sure, whatever. She grinned and lovingly bobbed Slippery Rabbit in her arms. I watched as he cleaned his ears and wiggled his whiskers up and down. I congratulated myself for going for the optional upgrade that also provided the rabbits with adorable little bow ties.
Said Merrill. Shouldn't he have changed back by now?
I stared at him. He twitched his nose. Some time later, as the sun was going down, we were sitting around a table in a nearby bar. The establishment was operating under the shallow pretense of being an entertainment venue, because there were a couple of boards set up on barrels in the corner as a makeshift stage, on which a trio of underdressed women were gyrating around, strangling each other. Merrill was still clutching Slippery John the Rabbit to her chest. Some of the dancers, who had spent several minutes squealing and scratching behind his adorable ears, had managed to find him some carrots, and he sat in Merrill's arms, toying with one of the uneaten stalks.
"How long has it been now?"
asked Merrill, again. 2 hours, I said. She rubbed her chin.
"How long are these spells supposed to last?"
"Seconds."
"So what does this mean?"
"I have no idea."
"I thought you were a magic student."
"It is because I was a magic student that I am completely without an explanation for this. As far as I knew, the world record for prolonged bunny morph was around 2 minutes."
"So it is possible to make the spell last longer?"
"Yes, if you're a top-level mage trained for competitive spellcasting." She rested her chin on her folded arms and thought for a moment.
"So what does this mean?"
"Could we please stop going back and forth between the same questions? I keep saying I've got no idea."
"But don't you have some kind of cure spell that turns rabbits into humans?"
"No, it does not work like that. Do you know how hard it is to turn one living thing into another living thing for longer than a second? The universe just doesn't tolerate it. The spell basically works by pointing over reality's shoulder and saying, look over there. It's not designed to last. The only possible explanation for this is that I have somehow become more powerful than God."
"Your blasphemy never ceases,"
blurted out Thaddeus, in what I'm pretty sure was some kind of reflex action. Experimentally, I turned him into a rabbit again. And sure enough, seconds later, he was right back to his grimacing self.
"Witness how the law deflects your corruption from my blessed form."
"Just for once, it'd be nice if you defied character and made some kind of helpful suggestion."
"The solution is to pray, heretic. Only the Lord may name who shalt person and who shalt bunny rabbit be."
I watched Slippery John some more. Praying seemed to be the last thing on his mind. He had lost interest in the carrot and had apparently defaulted to the other main instinct of rabbits, his little head alertly tossing left and right on the hunt for female bunnies.
Perhaps if we killed him, he'd come back as a human, said Merrill.
I shook my head. Polymorphed rabbits are indestructible.
Why?
Well, think about it. If you had a spell that could instantly transform any foe, regardless of size, into a convenient, fragile bunny rabbit, why would you need any others? It'd completely destroy the offensive magic industry.
Then I guess there's nothing we can do but wait.
I heard a powerful, authoritative cough. Behind me, I saw two black-suited Adventurers Guild agents in a booth, reading newspapers. One of them caught my eye for an instant, then slowly licked his finger and turned a page portentously. Clearly Mr. Wonderful was expecting fast results, and it probably wouldn't be long before his extremely limited patience gave out, and he decided that the well-being of his herb garden took priority. No, I said, making sure everyone heard. We can't waste any time. Come on, think! He must have said something to you about how he contacts his people.
Well, yeah, said Merrill. While you were on the beach, he mentioned that he got up to all kinds of secret business in the men's toilets in the park.
A few moments of silence passed as I considered this. Did he mention exactly what kind of secret business he was talking about?
Not really. Magic resistance business, I guess. He said there's some kind of tunnel entrance in there.
I drummed my fingers for a second, then stood up. I guess we'd better take a look, then. I turned my face partly towards the agents behind me. A look in the toilets in the park, that is. The toilet where we suspect might be found a tunnel. A tunnel that may lead us to the magic resistance, which we are still diligently looking for. One of the newspapers rustled in a gesture of acknowledgement.
That's the spirit, said Merrill, encouraged. Let's go.
Okay, then, I said. You bringing the bunny?
Sure am.
Could you stop him from doing that? She looked down.
Oh, come on, he just wants somewhere warm to hide.
The park turned out to be a network of bright green lawns and beautiful flower gardens, taking up a large chunk of the city's west side and bisected by the river. Of course, the knowledge that plants were as immortal as everything else spoiled the effect somewhat. The place would look forever beautiful no matter what the groundskeeper did, which explained why he was sitting motionlessly on a bench near the park entrance, leaning on his rake and no doubt contemplating suicide for the umpteenth time. The area around the toilets was one of the zones set aside for adventurers suffering from the final stage of syndrome. A small forest of men like sweaty bipedal horses, women like hip-thrusting shop-window mannequins, wispy elves like windswept ornamental trees, and dwarves like scowling piles of suet pudding. They stood in the usual syndrome poses, the men with hips thrust forward, the women presenting their chests and posteriors like barnyard hens. The only motion was the slight up-down movement as they filled and emptied their magnificent heroic lungs. The effect could have been eerie, and if there had been an ounce of perceptible humanity remaining in any of the buggers, it probably would have been. But as it was, the display was actually rather appealing. Children chased each other between the rows, and a young couple was sharing a sandwich and a bottle of wine between the legs of a particularly tall barbarian warrior. The toilets were located in a small, pleasant cottage-like building with a sign reading Relief Centre, because there is a certain kind of local authority who will reluctantly concede that toilets must exist, but feel there's no harm in dancing around the issue. Once again I could tangibly feel the massive distance between me and Garethy, where hanging actual toilet paper in the shithouse as opposed to old newspapers was considered hoity-toity. The interior of the gents was much closer to home. The custodian obviously hadn't dragged himself through here in a while. The stink was foul, the mirror was broken, and the corpse slumped against one of the sinks had probably injected himself with fatal amounts of illicit substances weeks ago, and no doubt a few more times since then.
"So what are we looking for, exactly?" I said. There was a long silence.
"Redemption for your ungodly sins," barked Thaddeus opportunistically. "Fall to your knees and plead for a righteous evaporation, foaming urine of demonic puppies."
I sighed and poked my head outside. "Merrill, just come in." She blushed yellowly.
"It's the boys' toilets."
"No one's around."
"Don't lie. You're around, and Thaddeus is around."
"We're not having a pissing contest, Merrill. We're looking for a tunnel. Get in here."
"Oh, fine."
She stepped gingerly into the room as if she were commencing a bout of firewalking, and her eye was immediately drawn to the corpse.
"Ooh. You know, I did always wonder what goes on in here. Any idea where the tunnel entrance could be?"
"Not yet." I was investigating one of the cubicles as well as I could without actually touching anything. "Wait, scratch that." She came in for a closer look.
"Slippery John's secret tunnel entrance," she read aloud.
The words were nestled in the middle of several items of graffiti detailing who was here and what kind of good times they could provide. I noticed that the rabbit was reaching out a paw, trying to touch the graffiti. I guess this is it. Unless it's a trick, but Slippery John doesn't strike me as the sophisticated type.
"So this must be the secret switch," said Merrill.
She leant forward and decisively pushed the brick inwards. It fell out the other side of the wall. "No, I think you just open it by the big ring in the floor," I said, crouching. The trapdoor was old and rusty, and the hinges squealed like a grief-stricken violin, but the rust had flaked off around the edges and the handle, so it had obviously been opened and closed many times in the recent past. A set of worn stone steps led down into the foul-smelling underbelly that the unrelenting beauty of the park was doing its damnedest to compensate for. We descended into a sort of disused basement sewer-type chamber, then the stairs ended and were supplanted by a sloping tunnel that must have been magically bored into the rock. The walls were an archaeologist's wet dream. As is usually the case with cities as old as Lowlead, most of the buildings had been regularly destroyed over the years by wars and barbarian invasions. So building contractors throughout history had saved time by laying foundations over the ruins and starting again. We descended through countless generations of broken architecture and fossilized artifacts, sandwiched together in layers, like a descending diagram representing the development of weapons technology. At the top, magical superweapons, then gunpowder, then crossbows, then swords, then sticks, then rocks, then magical superweapons again. We finally reached the bottom of the tunnel, somewhere around the third crossbow layer, and found ourselves in the middle of a centuries-old alley, the cobbled paving stones now inseparable from the petrified bones of the lucky bastards who died permanently while futilely defending these streets in some long-forgotten turf war. I summoned a small fireball and held it aloft to light the way. The rocky ceiling was barely a foot above our heads, and some of the stalactites almost reached the floor. It was like some colossal granite hedgehog had rolled onto the city and died.
"Old, isn't it?" said Merrill.
I stopped walking. "Surely even you ran that through your head before you spoke and realized how inane it was."
"All right, all right. Let's just keep going."
"Which way?" We had arrived at a junction. A great number of petrified skeletons were here, half sunk into the floor, and now inseparable from each other or the surrounding rock. The sight of either a particularly bloody ancient battle or some very dangerous traffic.
"Don't ask me," said Merrill, beaming at her own lack of sense. "You're the one who wanted to come down here."
"You scheme to lead my unsullied being to the corrupting satanic depths from which you spawned," interjected Thaddeus.
Truly your rejection of the Lord has left you cursed with demonic ignorance.
I tightened my lips, counted to 10, then turned to Merrill. Does Slippery John know?
You want me to ask him?
You got a better idea? We stared at each other, and her gaze dropped first. She sighed, pulled her neckline out, and spoke loudly and clearly into her dress.
Which way do we go, Slippery John?
The wobbling mass in her clothing jostled around for a second.
He's indicating the right.
I didn't move. How exactly is he indicating the right?
None of your business.
The right. I bounced the fireball thoughtfully up and down for a moment, looking back and forth at the two identical dark passageways. Okay, then. I took the right. It swiftly led into a narrow network of alleyways in the ancient city's red light district. Long-forgotten flyers and posters were still hanging on the walls, some still bearing faint images of exposed breasts and buttocks, whose owners had long since gone to dust, evidence of a saner, pre-infusion era. We were passing through the parking area behind a prehistoric strip club, when my firebolt reached its preset lifespan and fizzled out, plunging us into darkness. Instantly, I heard the stumbling skitter of something big and insect-like moving nearby. Slippery John gave a high-pitched wheeze as Merrill tensed up, hugging him tighter. I'd never had a problem with the dark, even less so now that the three of us were probably the most disquieting things in it. Still, there's something instinctively terrifying about hearing what sounded like the skittering of either a 6-foot cockroach or 500 regular-sized ones marching in eerily perfect unison. I summoned another fireball as fast as I could, just in time to see something on a nearby wall hastily disappear. I had only caught a glimpse, but it had vaguely resembled a drying rack wrapped in bone-white skin. I found that Merrill and I were suddenly standing back to back, while Slippery John had disappeared into the deepest recesses of her dress again. Thaddeus was a few feet away, watching us contemptuously. Maintaining fireballs for so long was rapidly draining my meagre magic reserves. The new one was already dimming. I could hear the scuttling noise from all around us now, and many pairs of milk-white eyes were peering at us from the surrounding blackness.
"Thaddeus," said Merrill from the corner of her mouth, "maybe you should come a bit closer to the light."
The priest was at the edge of the illumination my magic could offer, arms proudly folded.
"Ask me not to warm myself at the sputterings of demonic conjuration. I am already closer to the light than you, abominable—"
He had to stop, then, because a skinny white arm had snapped across his mouth. Several more seized his limbs and torso. The arms were stick-thin and pure white, but unmistakably humanoid. They hauled Thaddeus back into the shadows and out of sight. But we heard him loudly and determinedly singing hymns all the way till he was out of earshot.
"They took Thaddeus! They took Thaddeus!" whined Merrill.
"I noticed! I noticed!" By then I was already running through the tunnels, holding the fireball in front of me like a relay runner, our pursuers scuttling close behind. I barely made 50 yards before I tripped on a bit of curb and fell catastrophically onto my chin. I was pulled onto my back and restrained by countless pairs of skinny, grasping hands. Somewhere nearby I heard Merrill yelp as she, too, was taken down. But I kept concentrating on the fireball, and was able to keep it going about a foot above my face for long enough to finally get a proper look at our captors. They were human, or at least had been once. Now they looked like asylum patients who had been coated in plaster dust and had all their body fat sucked out. Their eyes were pale and squinted against even the pathetic light my magic could provide. But as my reserves dwindled and the fireballs shrank, they drew closer with increasing audacity
and brazen lack of concern for personal space. The face of a particularly wizened albino appeared upside down in my vision. His cracked and paper-thin lips parted, and after the usual spontaneous heave at the first sight of my face, he spoke. "Will you turn off that bloody light?" he whispered. "Sorry," I said automatically, snuffing it out. Only then did I think to refuse, but it wouldn't have mattered. My magic reserves were depleted anyway. "People are trying to sleep," he hissed. He spoke with tremendous difficulty, as if he'd only just learned how to talk from a narcoleptic chain smoker, or indeed that he'd spent most of his life in an underground cave. He also had a tendency to quickly intake breath at odd points in his sentences. "You will not steal the treasure." "We don't want to steal your treasure." "Seriously?" "Yes," I offered a silent prayer of thanks that Slippery John was in no position to talk. "Then why did you come down here?" "We're just looking for some people. We didn't even know you had a treasure." "We don't." I wondered when someone was going to hand me the script for this scene. "What?" "We don't have any treasure." "Then why would you assume we're looking for it?" His voice suddenly rose from a hiss to an angry squawk. "We don't freaking know! We have adventurer clots down here every freaking week looking for treasure we don't freaking have. They think it just grows down here or something." He sounded very put upon. "Can we just get out of your way?" I asked. "Who are you looking for, anyway?" "The magic resistance." It was like dropping the local cat's name at a mouse festival. The crowd of underground dwellers collectively gasped, like 5-year-olds responding to the sound of Mum's favourite vase smashing to the floor. I'd become accustomed enough to the dark to see that the elder was staring so hard his eyeballs were about to plop out and bounce off my face. The little grasping hands rapidly pulled me to my feet and withdrew. I felt a couple of them return to hastily dust down my robe. "Well, it would be remiss of us to not point you in the right direction," said the leader. "Less said, soonest mended. Sorry about handling you like that and accusing you of... Would you like to kick me in the stomach a few times to make up for it?" The elder and his associates gently led us back through the darkened streets to the junction where we'd made what had turned out to be the wrong decision. I summoned another small fireball, and they jumped back with little surprised yelps. "Just head along this way and follow the signs," said the elder, his pointing finger the only visible part of him. "Where's Thaddeus?" asked Merrill. There was some frantic whispering in the dark. "Would it be okay if we hung on to him for a while? Apparently he's telling us some really intriguing things about our relationship with the Lord." "Yes," I said immediately. "Hold on to him for as long as you want."
"You're too kind, sir. Good luck."
He attempted to scrabble away from us, but there was some more urgent whispering from his fellows, and he was pushed back into conversation with us.
Sorry, he said. "We just need to know. On the surface, the infusion of immortality. Is it still going on?"
Yeah. His glowing eyes disappeared for a moment as he hung his head in sorrow.
"Okay."
He turned.
back inside, everyone. We'll give it another 10 years.
The scuttling sound scuttled away. I glanced at Merrill, then opted to start along the underground street before she leapt on the opportunity to say something stupid. We barely made 20 feet.
"Hey," she said, "do you think those guys are scared of the magic resistance?"
I didn't look at her. "I wonder how you got that impression."
"It was the way—"
"Rhetorical!" That was a rhetorical statement. She was only able to shut up for a few yards.
"I do feel bad about Thaddeus. Maybe we should think about rescuing him later."
"He's useless."
"That's so cold. Would you just abandon me if I was useless?"
A pause.
"What's that look for?"
Before long, we happened upon what I presumed were the signs the leader albino had mentioned. "Turn back" was the most direct of them. Others included "horrendous danger" and "trespassers will undergo the torments of all the damned." The further we advanced, the more urgent and tightly packed the signs became, until finally they all rather ominously disappeared, and the narrow underground street opened out into a large plaza, too vast for my fireball to fully illuminate. We were soon alone in a circle of yellow light, no walls to be seen. I suddenly became aware that I was hearing not two, but three sets of footfalls. The third one was trying as hard as it could to sync up with mine. I stopped and heard a faint stumble as they were caught off guard. "Who's there?" I called.
"It's me," said Merrill.
"Merrill!"
"Hi!"
I meant... Suddenly a cold breath of wind swept by, ruffling my sleeve. I spun around, and my fireball deformed madly and disappeared, as if some great and terrible magic force had simply absorbed it. Merrill grabbed my shoulder.
"Where are you?" I yelled.
"I'm here."
"Merrill, shut!"
Her voice had come from several feet away. The hand on my shoulder belonged to someone considerably closer. I said carefully. "Do you know the magic resistance?" Something dark and bag-like was pulled over my eyes. Then something long and stick-like whacked me over the head. Double Bill signed in at 22:13 p.m.
"Hey, man. Can't sleep?"
"I told you to stop trying to talk to me after work. Especially after 10. That's my special me time."
"Sorry. Were you jerking off?"
"Yes. What do you want?"
"Are you as concerned about Simon as I am?"
"In the sense that I'm concerned he's going to suffocate with all those dicks in his face."
"Be serious. You think he's been acting weird lately? More than usual?"
"Yeah, but since he's not talking as much, I'm not complaining."
"All he does is sit at his desk playing the build, talking to that pet NPC of his."
"Yes, yes, yes, we all work in the same office, you know. I've seen him sitting there with his mouth hanging open like a retard. Guess he gave up on making any real friends."
"That's the thing. Simon talks about Barry like he's really a person."
"I know, it's creepy."
"No, I mean, maybe Barry is a person."
"Okay, time for you to shut up and go to bed."
"Just listen. If Barry can converse with Simon like a person, then that means our AI passes the Turing test."
"Oh, wow, you're right. What a truly momentous day in the history of technology, is what I would be saying if AIs hadn't passed the Turing test years ago. We've been over this. Passing the Turing test doesn't mean anything. Even if it seems like a person, it's always just running on preset responses to preset stimuli on more and more complex levels."
"Yeah, but maybe the human mind is no different."
"Oh, God, you've been watching Star Trek again, haven't you?"
"No."
"You answered too fast. You totally have. It always makes you talk like Captain Picard."
"FYI, it was DS9.
The bag was yanked roughly from my head, and my octopus retinas were immediately dazzled by a spotlight. I was sitting hunched forward with my arms tied behind a backrest and my ankles bound to chair legs. Even had it been a decent size, the chair was too hard to come within earshot of comfortable, but it seemed to have been sized for a schoolboy. That fit, because there was an intensity in the room that evoked a meeting with the headmaster. "Mr. Wonderful?" I hazarded, even though I couldn't smell the usual pungent mix of metal and sweat-drenched silk that usually marked his presence.
"Who are you?"
They were speaking through a voice-disguising spell. Their words sounded like a baritone singer with a sore throat was speaking them into a metal drum at the bottom of a well. "My name's Jim." That didn't seem like enough. "Don't look into my eyes, you'll throw up."
"I am conditioned to be unaffected by such things."
"Oh, you liar," said another voice. It was also disguised, but the pitch was higher. "You should have seen him earlier, dear. Your bag came off while you were out and he was hosing down the entire back passage."
"Why did you have to tell him that?"
went the first voice, bravely retaining its dignified, powerful voice.
"Do you do it just to get a rise out of me? Is that it?"
"I thought you wanted to ask him questions, not me." The first voice cleared its throat. It sounded like a sink being unblocked inside a broken church bell.
"What is your last name?"
"I don't know," I said. "It's usually just Jim." I heard paper rustling.
"James Rufus Bottomroach," said the first voice. "Does that name ring a bell?"
I sighed. "Yes, that's me."
"Hey," came Merrill's voice from somewhere in the darkness surrounding me. "You said you couldn't remember your last name."
"It came back a while ago, back at Dreadgraves," I said miserably. I was hoping if I ignored it, it would go away again.
"Member of the Bottomroach family of pig farmers in Beauregard, Garethy. Ran away from home in defiance of your father's desire that you follow his trade. Enrolled at St. Gordon's Magical College, and completed 1 year of a beginner's degree in applied combat magic. Killed at the age of 23 by an invading force of warrior students from Stragonoff, which event led to the warrior school in question being closed down by the legal action of several bereaved parents."
"Including my parents?" The paper rustled again.
"No, your parents couldn't even afford to have your body returned to Beauregard. It was anonymously interred in a cemetery in Goodsoil County. That was 65 years ago.
"Sounds like you've had it pretty rough, poor duck," said the other voice. "Mind you, I hope I look as good as you when I'm 88, only with a nose."
"The details of your life are mere trivia," continued the first voice. "The interesting part is the fact that a young man who met a sticky end 65 years ago is currently sitting before us, fully capable of movement, thought, and articulate conversation."
"Always takes you so long to get to the point, doesn't it? It's like you can't get enough of the sound of your own voice."
"If you weren't my wife, woman..."
"And now you've given away that we're married. Now we could take that information, figure out our identities, and do something devious with them."
"Well, it was pretty obvious," pointed out Merrill.
"You were returned to life by one Brutus Dreadgrave," continued the husband testily. "A privately funded necromancer, who seized control of Good Soil County, apparently in order to experiment with the raising of individuals who died before the infusion. Apparently his success was even greater than any of us.